Welcome to the Testimony Podcast, people of faith telling the stories that matter from their lives. I'm your host, Andrew Chamberlain, and I'm delighted that you can join us for this conversation. You can subscribe to the Testimony Podcast on all of the major podcast distributors and follow us on Twitter at TestimonyCast and Instagram at Testimony Podcast. And welcome to episode 12 of the Testimony Podcast. My guest for this episode is a man who has lived in some very diverse places across the world, from Delhi to Scotland and from Munich to London and Cambridge in the UK. He has worked in academia, broadcasting and business consultancy, and for over 20 years, he was employed at the very highest level by the Swiss bank UBS, advising on threats and opportunities to their business. After a long journey of faith, as someone who is passionate about his homeland, India, he became a Hindu follower of Jesus. As such, he recognizes Jesus as his Lord and Savior, but his identity and especially his national identity is as an Indian and so as a Hindu. And in this conversation, he addresses the issue of why every Hindu should consider becoming a follower of Jesus. In his life, he has enjoyed challenge and success, grief and joy. And in our conversation, we explore how we should live with unresolved questions, how to focus on our blessings, and how any follower of Jesus should take up their cross and follow him. This is a conversation with the publisher, poet, and business consultant, Prabhu Guptara. And this episode reflects the emotion and passion that he feels about the joys and challenges that he's experienced in his life. This is his story. Prabhu, welcome to the Testimony Podcast. It's great to have you as our guest today. I wondered if you could start by telling us a little bit about your career and then go on to tell us about what you're up to now.
Yes, sure. Well, the very first job I did was as a kind of market researcher for a summer, which was very great experience because I was going to the slums of Delhi and talking to these slum dwellers about what kinds of soft drinks they had. And I discovered later, of course, that the work had been commissioned by Coca-Cola. So here was a Western company selling a relatively expensive product, colored water, as one person memorably put it, to very poor people. And of course, I was very pleased to do the work. It was a good experience there. But my first proper job was teaching at the University of Delhi, where I taught for 3 years. And then I moved from undergraduate teaching to postgraduate teaching at the Northeastern Hill University in Shillong, which is in the northeast of India, miles and miles, 1,600 miles away. And it's a part of India which is very different from the mainland of India. It's cut off from the country by a neck of land which is only 16 kilometers wide, squashed between Nepal and Bangladesh, which connects this rather large part of India to the mainstream of India. I taught there for 3 years, and then I fell foul of a national emergency launched by Prime Minister Indira Gandhi to protect her own seat, her own power base. And I regarded her as a very intelligent woman, but I thought she had done something very stupid, and I made my view absolutely plain. And as a result of doing that, I was kicked out of the country. Well, I was given a choice, and the choice was that I could join the party or leave the country.
I presume join the party means retract your criticism, not say anything, not step out of line. That was their way of kind of keeping you on a short leash sort of thing.
That's right. And actually become a member of the party, member of the party apparatus, which was ruling the country at that time. You know, one party straight, it was all going in the direction of authoritarianism. So I was kicked out of the country, or I chose to leave the country, to be very precise, rather than join the party, and landed in Scotland. My wife and I had £107 and a few pence between us, and actually £106 and a few pence between us. Then we did all kinds of things to survive, you know, washing dishes, checking tickets at theatres, waiting at bars, whatever we could to survive.
Yeah.
And then I was appointed the warden in one of the halls of residence at Stirling University, which is where I was, which was an unpaid position, but gave us free accommodation. And free electricity and free running water and all that. One of the warden's flats, you know. And my wife, Philippa, was able to find a job in the university while I pursued research there. So that was a very good combination. We had the money, we had the flat, you know, it worked fine. And then our first son was born, and we came south intending to go back to India at that stage because the government had changed. And I thought I would then continue my PhD studies and finance them somehow by working, because my wife wasn't working anymore. Our first son had been born. And that then turned into the struggle to survive again. And again, I did all kinds of things to be able to survive, but this time including writing and broadcasting both on radio and television, and then discovered the world of consultancy by, as it were, accident, divine accident, and then pursued that because that, of course, produced much more money than writing and broadcasting did, at least in my case it did, and ended up working internationally for all kinds of companies. So I was an international business consultant running a small consultancy. And among my clients was the largest bank in the world. And they made me an offer that was very difficult to refuse. And so I moved to Switzerland, where I lived for 21 years, worked for the bank for 15 years, retired from the bank at the normal age of retirement, and came back to England for family reasons in 2016.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you've done more recently? What have you been doing in the last 2 or 3 years then?
Well, we came to England in November 2016, and my wife, Philippa, was not feeling very well. So we took her along to the local doctors, and they prescribed tests. And in January, the diagnosis was cancer. And so for 2 years, she fought it. And then in January last year, that's 2019, she was promoted to heaven, as we say in my language. And so I was, of course, in shock and grief and all that for months. And then through a series of things, I'm not sure it's worth going into the detail, I just felt that God was telling me to restart a publishing house that my wife had started just before we moved, totally, suddenly, and unexpectedly to Switzerland to take up this job there. And when we did that, of course, learning a new language, putting children through school in a strange culture and all that meant poor Philippa had no energy time to pursue the publishing. And so it kind of dried up. And so I restarted the publishing house. So in addition to the work that I do in consultancy for boards and so on, which is my professional work, and in addition to writing poetry, which is what I restarted once Philippa was diagnosed with cancer, I used to write poetry in my teens and 20s. And then, of course, because of the pressure of work and survival, you know, I wasn't writing much poetry. But when she was diagnosed with cancer, then I restarted writing poetry. So those are two legs, as it were, the consultancy, the poetry, and then the third leg now has been publishing, which has actually taken up a huge amount of my time over the last year and a half or whatever.
Now. Okay, that's great. Now, I want to explore with you, if I may, just an aspect of your beliefs, because I know that you describe yourself as a Hindu follower of Jesus. I think that's correct.
Yes.
And this is not a term that I had come across until quite recently, and I've been having a look into what that actually means. But what better way to find out than to actually ask somebody who would identify as that? So I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about how you came to that point. What does that phrase actually mean for you, and how does that work in your context?
Well, it's probably worth my starting the story at the beginning, because when I was 8, my father died, and I promptly became an atheist for reasons I won't go into. It had nothing to do directly only with his death. It had to do with the fact that because of the way finances were organized at the time, remember, partition had taken place in India not long before that.
Yes.
The whole of society had been turned upside down, commerce, everything had been turned upside down. And due to reasons that I won't go into, the arrangements were that if my father had lived 1 month longer, just 1 month longer, we would have come into insurance money, life insurance money, that we didn't come into because he died at that point. So the fact that my dad had to die was obvious. Everybody dies at some point. Why now, you say? Okay, you can always ask that question. But why now, 1 month short of when we could have got some money, was a kind of, you know, completely inexplicable thing to my 8-year-old mind. Because I could see the consequence of that. And the consequence of that was that my mother had to work very hard to bring us up. But that was not the only reason for that, but that was one reason for it. So anyway, I became an atheist, and I continued to be an atheist till I entered my teens. And as usually happens to people in their teens, I started thinking. And I realized that while it was fine to be an atheist because you were angry with God, upset with God, hurt with God, disappointed with God, once you had reached the conclusion that there is no God, then the conclusion also followed that the universe was meaningless. And the conclusion also followed that my life and every human life and all human aspirations and all human efforts and everything we busy ourselves with is entirely meaningless. Now, as long as you're healthy and fit and young and have money, you don't need to face the consequences of that too much because after all, you're enjoying what you have. Why not enjoy what you have? But that was not my situation. I was young-ish. I was fit-ish. But we were not well off. And my mother was struggling like anything to make, often working 24-hour days at a stretch to earn enough money for us to survive. And this was not a situation in which you could say, oh, well, life is hunky-dory, life is fine, carry on.
Yeah.
It was a situation in which you were brought face-to-face with the fact that if life ultimately was meaningless, then really you may as well commit suicide. Now, I wasn't going to do it because I knew it would hurt my mother. But why should my mother not commit suicide with us? So anyway, thinking about all that, I realized that maybe the conclusion I'd come to was not entirely satisfactory. Maybe at least there was a possibility that there might be a God. And if so, I wanted to find out. So I went to the local temples, I went to the local mosques, I went to the local churches, I went to the local gurdwaras. And because I was living, we were living right in the center of Delhi, absolutely bang in the center of Delhi, within walking distance, there were churches, there were gurdwaras, there were temples, there were mosques right around us. So I went in turn to each of these and I talked to them and I asked and so on. Again, I won't go into the details, but eventually I ended up becoming a follower of Jesus. And when I became a follower of Jesus, I thought I'd become a Christian. And so I did all the things that Christians normally do. And I realized after some time that not all Christians are followers of Jesus. Some Christians are and some Christians aren't. And this is in India, of course, where Christians are a minority. And you'd think as a minority, if they were going to be Christians, they'd take their faith very seriously. Well, as I say, some did and some didn't. So this was very puzzling and upsetting to me. I couldn't really come to terms with it. And then I discovered that there were Hindus who follow Jesus. And I realized that actually, our scriptures, the Indian scriptures, the Hindu scriptures, foretell the coming of Jesus in a very clear way. And so, having thought about it a lot and having tossed this around in my mind, I decided actually the right position for me was as a Hindu follower of Jesus because it expressed me better and it expressed the gospel, particularly in the Indian context, better than being a Christian. Because as a Christian, you're always going to have to argue why it is that some Christians follow Jesus and some Christians don't, etc., etc. Whereas a Hindu follower of Jesus in India, and you're focusing on Jesus, because that is the center, that is the person who I fell in love with. And that is the person who died for me. It isn't Christianity that died for me. It isn't the church that died for me. Western churches didn't die for me. It was Jesus who died for me. And Jesus who rose again, and Jesus is the person that I'm in relationship with. And so I'm a Hindu who follows Jesus. And so that's been my identity for decades.
Okay. So as a Hindu follower of Jesus then, can you talk to us about one or maybe or two perhaps episodes in your life or incidents where you have felt close to Jesus? And this may be because things were going really well, or it could be because things were going really badly. But you've had a very strong sense, perhaps, of his companionship and guidance and comfort with you.
Yes. Well, clearly, the moment when I became a follower of Jesus, and immediately after that, it was new love, if you see what I mean. And then the Lord was certainly very close to me, or I felt very close to him, whichever way you want to put it. There were all kinds of conundrums and problems and difficulties, but I felt very close to the Lord then. But I actually find it much easier to talk about the times when I did not feel close to the Lord.
Okay.
And the 17 years of exile following my political exile from India.
Yeah.
17 years it was between that time and the time I landed this plum job in Switzerland. And those years were years of exile for me. Spiritually, those were years of exile. Partly, of course, because of financial problems, which were with me till about 1990. So about 10 years, I guess, 12 years, 13 years, you could argue, when things were very bad, bad or not so bad, but certainly not good. And it's only following the job in Switzerland that the situation then became stably good for ages. I mean, it was improving all the time.
Okay.
But it was only when I landed the job, that's the break between the time that financially it was a struggle to being just okay and being concerned about expansion and growing your base and all that to a point where you knew you were okay.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
So the financial side was one side, but the deeper thing was a spiritual alienation, because you see, I was brought up as a nationalist, and for a nationalist to have to leave his country is very difficult, is very deep.
Hmm.
And here you are in a foreign culture, first in Scotland, which is very strange for an Indian.
Yeah, I bet it was.
And then once you adjusted to that a little bit over 3 years, you then land in England, which is very different from the Scottish culture and equally alien to me.
Mm.
So it then took me several years, of course, to adjust to English culture as distinct from Scottish culture. But the unresolved question in my mind was, Lord, you made me an Indian. You gave me a love for my nation, and I'm exiled from it. What's the point? And I could not see the point. I could not see the point for years and years and years.
Mm.
And it was only after I landed the job in Switzerland and been through the period of, as it were, training and induction, and I'd been handed my first real assignment in the bank, that I was sitting in my office of an evening, actually my legs on my table, I can still visualize it, overlooking Lake Constance. Beautiful view, absolutely stunningly beautiful view. And I was obviously talking to Jesus and saying, okay, Lord, here I am. I've got my first assignment now. How shall I go about it? And then it suddenly struck me. Here I was in Switzerland overlooking this absolutely beautiful landscape in the evening. And I thought, what am I doing here? And as I said that to the Lord then showed me that starting with my first job teaching in Delhi, my calling had been to speak from secular platforms on secular topics, but from a biblical point of view. And that's what I'd done through all this time and all these different roles that I'd had and different things that I'd done, not very faithfully perhaps, not very consistently perhaps, but that is what I had done. And now the Lord told me that I would not stop doing that, but now the Lord is going to use me to create a platform for other people, to train other people to do the same thing. And it was only there that the penny finally dropped what God was trying to do with me.
Mm.
So my nationalism has never left me. But what the Lord wanted to do was make me a global thinker. He wanted me to understand what was going on around the world. And God had been busy opening my head, my mind, my personality all these years, and I hadn't seen it.
Mm.
So for those 17 years of exile, it was also a kind of spiritual exile for me.
Mm.
I had not stopped following Jesus. I had not stopped talking to Jesus. I was still following Jesus, but with a deep ache in my heart.
Mm. Mm. So I think it's clear from this conversation that you have a deep and abiding passion for your nation, for India, and that is kind of interweaved into you. And yet God took you out, or allowed you to be taken out, whichever way you want to look at it, from that. And you were, it almost kind of comes to mind the idea that you were kind of ripped away from a place that was your home. And then you had to endure 17 years of not understanding the purposes or not understanding why. And I think this is one of the big challenges of following Jesus over a long period of time, that there are periods in your life where you just don't see the whole picture. And I think it's interesting you say you didn't stop following Jesus, you didn't walk away, but there was this deep ache in your soul throughout all that time. I think that in a way is, though, is an encouragement to people who are going through those times, that there is a purpose yet, but that actually God does things in his own time. And sometimes we have to wait a long time for it. I wondered if you could just comment on that a little bit further, just tell us a little bit more about your experiences in that way.
I think I want to say that, you know, all questions are not resolved. Many questions are not resolved on this earth. Mm. And it's only from the perspective of eternity we'll be able to see what the purposes were. So there are many conundrums, there are many questions, unanswered questions in my life to do with my current situation, with Philippa being taken to heaven last January, with my sister being killed in the explosion in the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, with my mother dying of grief, really, from that. And the consequences of all those things, I could talk about many consequences from them as well. Mm. So there are all kinds of unanswered questions in my heart still. Mm. And I'm sure that as God showed me the answer to that question, which I shared about, you know, why have you taken me out of India? Yeah. So I'm sure that God will show me the answers to some of those questions in time here on earth.
Yeah.
I would not at all be surprised if most of those questions I don't get an answer to till I'm in eternity with Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's only then that I'll see what God was about, what Jesus was about. We experience life on this earth as being so hugely important for us. And of course it is. But all of life is just a blip in the context of eternity. And when we are in eternity, we will be able to see all of life spread out before us like a canvas. Mm. And we'll be able to say, oh, so that's what you were about. Oh, I see. So that had that impact. Mm. And that was a consequence. And that influenced that. Oh, I see. I see. I see.
Mm.
But at present, I don't.
No.
And at present, I live with those aches.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there things which you practice within your spiritual life which help you to live with those aches? They don't solve the problem. I think these things aren't just going to go away, but how do you manage with that?
Well, one is you focus on your blessings, because that's what the Bible tells us to do. That's the instruction book for our life. And we are told in no uncertain terms that we have to remember the blessings that God mm-hmm. gives us. So you remember the blessings.
Yeah.
And you don't ignore the questions. You hold the questions up before God and you say, Lord, I don't have the answer to this question. I trust you for the answer. And I know that someday I will have the answer, whether on earth or in eternity. But you count your blessings. That's what you do. And the second thing that you do is that you take your aches to God. I don't think I do enough of that. I think I suppress a lot of my aches and my hurts. But when I can't suppress them, then I take them to Jesus and I talk to Jesus about them.
Mm. Mm.
And I know that he understands, and I know that he puts his arm around me, and sometimes I can feel it and sometimes I can't. Mm. So remember your blessings. Talk about my griefs with God. And thirdly, sing. I find singing a huge, 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 huge thing, because, of course, it's very difficult to sing in some situations. It's very difficult to sing in some moods. But in singing, I find a relief for the pressure that builds up inside me. In singing, I find a way of expressing my love to God and of seeing my situation in context. And song is just wonderful. And I'm just reminded of Paul, who was in prison, who was in the stocks with his hands and his feet tied up. And he didn't know for how long, but he sang in prison.
Mm. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And so When I feel in a prison, then I try to sing.
Mm. So there is that kind of biblical precedent for that, isn't it? I guess that yeah. Maybe singing perhaps as you, I think you've said this, singing allows an authentic expression of something that saying words wouldn't allow.
And I find that the great classical hymns, whether in my own language, Hindi, when I say my own language, I mean the language I'm most comfortable in. My mother's language, which is technically my mother tongue, I'm actually not that comfortable in because I haven't used it that much. But the hymns in my mother, the classical hymns in my mother's language, Malayalam, or in English, the classical hymns, are the hymns that are the most helpful.
Mm.
Because they take you, each hymn takes you through a sort of journey,
yeah.
Intellectually, spiritually, historically, it takes you through a journey.
Yeah.
And that journey enables you to put your experiences in a much wider context. So you see your griefs, sorrows, challenges, opportunities, joys, ambitions, hopes, whatever they are, in that very much larger context.
So what advice would you give to the world, or what lessons have you learned? If you could have a kind of channel to everybody for a moment, what are the one or two important things that you would be saying to people?
I find that what is absolutely key to my survival as a follower of Jesus, absolutely key to my spiritual survival, was soaking myself in the Bible. And had I not soaked myself in the Bible, and had my thinking not begun to be shaped by the Bible, I would not have survived this tough time that I had.
Mm.
And I'm still having in many ways.
Mm. Now, one other thing I want to ask you, anybody who's listening to this who is a Hindu may ask you the question, why would I as a Hindu follow Jesus? Why on earth would I do that?
It's an absolutely basic question, of course. And I think there is one thing you must remember, that every person who is of Indian origin, every Hindu anyway, is a person who is on a spiritual quest. And the spiritual quest is to find God.
Hmm.
The spiritual quest is to achieve liberation, spiritually, liberation. And we are prescribed various things by different traditions within the broad tradition that is called Hindu.
Mm.
There are all kinds of different traditions within that, which prescribe various routes to moksha, to release spiritual liberation to God, if you like. And we spend our lives doing that. We flagellate ourselves. We go into ascetic practices. We go on pilgrimages. We give devotion to individuals and to idols. You know, there is a huge amount of effort that is put into finding God and seeking liberation.
Mm.
And I think the question that any Hindu person has to ask is, how many people do I know who are serious Hindus who really invest time, energy, money, and so on in these spiritual practices, who find God? And if we will claim to find God, and in the Indian tradition, there are many people who claim to have found God, who claim to be realized souls, they have achieved spiritual liberation.
Mm.
If you then look at their lifestyles, are you really convinced that they have found God? All I can say is I looked around and I didn't find very many people who would qualify. And I looked at the teachings of all the traditions in India. Well, I can't say all the major traditions in India, and I give lectures on the subject in temples and in universities and all that.
Mm.
I looked at all of them, and honestly, nobody begins to hold a candle to Jesus.
Mm.
And the reason for that is that our traditions, generally speaking, try to escape from personality, try to escape from reality, and try to escape from ethics. So the more spiritual you are, the more you seek escape from these things. And the realized soul is he or she, rarely she, but theoretically, possibly she, who has abandoned the self, abandoned the world, and abandoned human ethics. Humane ethics. I don't mean human ethics. Humane ethics. Mm. By contrast, in Jesus, you have somebody who has gone into total selflessness in that he gave his life on the cross for us voluntarily, but who did not then abandon the world and did not ask his disciples to abandon the world, but rather called on them to engage with improving the world, reforming the world, healing the world, educating the world, and so on. And so far from abandoning ethics, really emphasized that. So that anybody who chooses to follow Jesus is engaged in this struggle to examine himself or herself, to see what is wrong inside me, ethically, morally, in the way I've been thinking, in the way I've been feeling, in what's been going through my mind, and exercising discretion in exercising discernment in understanding what is of the darkness and what is of the light, what is immoral versus what is moral, what is ethical versus what is unethical, what is loving as against what is not loving. So somebody who sets out to follow Jesus sets out on a path to bring his own natural character that he's been born with or she's been born with into line with God's character. That's what Jesus, that's what I understand Jesus was talking about when he said, if you want to follow me, you must take up your cross and follow me. What does that mean? That means saying basically no to your instinct for survival. There's no instinct deeper than the instinct for survival, right? That's a very deep thing. But it's not just physical survival we are talking about. It's that which is deep inside me, which says, I, and doesn't want to say you to God. It's a very deep thing. We all want to go our own way. We all think we are right. We all want to defend ourselves and so on. And Jesus calls us not to defend ourselves. Jesus calls us to examine ourselves. Jesus asks us to accuse ourselves so that we can say in a very deep way, yes, to God, so that our character can be transformed into becoming like God's character.
And it is in the life and character of Jesus that you have found that and not elsewhere.
I haven't. And, you know, I'm always open to being educated. So if somebody says, hey, Prabhu, you missed X or Y, I'm always open to looking. I'm always happy to look. But, you know, I've been looking from the age of 13 or 14. I'm now 71 years old.
You haven't found it yet.
I haven't found it yet. I haven't found anybody who begins to touch Jesus in terms of love, in terms of self-sacrifice, in terms of the quality of his teachings, in terms of what he does in the life of his followers, if they want to take him seriously. I have just not found anybody who does that kind of transformation of people.
So we're coming to the end of our conversation now. Is there anything else you want to say briefly, just to close?
I am astonished at the level of ignorance about Jesus that I find in the West. That my people in India are ignorant about Jesus is not astonishing, because Jesus was not historically a dominant part of our culture. You know, the message of Jesus came to India in AD 52, or even earlier, possibly. I won't go into that, but maybe it came much earlier than that. But it was always a very, very tiny stream, and it's still a tiny stream in India. But in the West, which claims to have a Christian heritage, to have people who've never seen a copy of the Bible, let alone having read it, never seen a copy of the Bible, this is a situation of the West that I find today. I would only say, rid yourself of the illusion that you know the first thing about Jesus. Rid yourself of the illusion that you understand anything about what the Bible teaches, and go and read the New Testament for yourself. Read the biography, life story of Jesus for yourself. And you will be astonished at how little you knew and how much there is to discover and how life-giving Jesus is.
Okay. That's probably a good place to stop, I think.
Prabhu, thank you so much for your time. I know some of what you've shared with us today is quite personal, and we appreciate you sharing that part of your story with us.
Thank you, Andy. It's a privilege to be with you on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Testimony Podcast. You can subscribe to the Testimony Podcast on all of the major podcast distributors and follow us on Twitter at TestimonyCast and Instagram at Testimony Podcast. If you want to find out more about the Christian faith and connect with someone to talk about your experiences or answer your questions, just go to www.christianity.org.uk from wherever you are in the world. That's www.christianity.org.uk. I look forward to sharing more of the stories that matter from people of faith with you soon. Until then, thank you for listening and goodbye.